This is DNFM. I'm Sam Solomon. DNFM features the latest stories in design and tech, brought to you by Designer News. This is episode 7. So welcome back, everybody. I'm pretty excited for this episode of DNFM. Today's guest is literally the guy that wrote the book on product design. That's right. Today's guest is Randy J. Hunt. For those of you that don't know, Randy is the Vice President of Design at Etsy. He is the author of Product Design for the Web, and he's also just an all-around great guy to talk shop with. So we'll have that interview later in the episode. We've also got our guest roundtable is back, so Payam from Shopify is going to be joining Kieran and I, and we're going to sit down and talk about Figma and Subform and kind of the state of design tools. But you know the drill. First, we've got a word from our sponsor and a few announcements. This week's episode of DNFM is brought to you by the fine folks at Dropmark. Dropmark is the smart way to organize all of your links, files, and notes into visual collections. It's perfect for individuals and teams alike. Creative teams use Dropmark to share ideas, review designs, and collect feedback. So say goodbye to all those links lost in the chat room abyss. Organize everything into collections and stacks for different projects or clients. Use search and hashtags to find what you need faster. How will your team use Dropmark? Visit dropmark.com/teams to learn more. Dropmark, all your stuff in one simple, visual, private place. We've got just a few quick announcements about upcoming Designer News events. Our San Francisco meetup will be happening on October 20th, and that's being hosted by the good-looking folks at Udemy. Once again, that's on October 20th. San Francisco is always one of the largest events we host, so I would encourage you to come out, have a couple beers with some of your fellow designers, and just be a part of the action. Following San Francisco, our next meetup will be in Austin, Texas. That will be early November. I don't have too many details right now, but definitely stay tuned and pay attention. More details are definitely soon to follow. All right, that's it. So it's been a few episodes since we've had a roundtable. We had Joel from DigitalOcean back in, I think it was episode 2 or 3. We're going to try and do this segment a little bit more often. But today I've got Payam Rajabi, who is from Shopify here. Also, Kieran from the Designer News team is here. The past couple weeks, we've seen several stories about design tools make it to the front page of Designer News. And just to list a few of them, we've got the launch of Figma and several Figma-related stories. Subform has raised a bunch of money on Kickstarter. Affinity Designer 1.5, they've added a ton of tools and features for interface designers. There's a new version of Flinto for Mac. I mean, there's just a ton of stuff that's happened in the last week. I thought instead of trying to address maybe each one of these different tools separately and each one of these different posts separately, we would try and have a conversation around the state of design tools itself. Payam, you're actually in Figma's office right now, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm just hanging out with couple of the folks here. So I've known Dylan Field for quite a while, and I've been using Figma pretty much for the last 2 years, 2.5 years, when it was still in alpha and under wraps. So I've been a huge fan of the way they're approaching this problem. So I was in the Bay Area this week visiting some old friends, and I just dropped by the office today, and been talking to some of the designers and engineers here, and trying to help them feel my pain with the kind of problems that we face at Shopify, and help them better understand like what I'm really hoping a tool could do. And it's been a lot of fun, and we've just been sharing a lot of ideas. It's definitely for me one of the tools that I would put a lot of my money on.
Well, the interesting thing about Figma, to me, the layout is very similar to Sketch. Like if you'd use Sketch, you could open Figma and figure it out. One of the things that I did think surprised me is I had not expected it to be as responsive as a web application. That was something that was surprising also because I was in that, I guess, that giant one where there were like 50 people typing and doing stuff, but I don't know if I want to be designing in my browser. Like, I don't know if that's something that, to me, maybe it's just because I'm a creature of habit, but to me, that's something that kind of feels bizarre.
No,
do you feel that way?
No, I think there are a lot of realistic reasons why you would want to use a native app when you think about things like, you know, the Mac OS ecosystem and things like mission control and being able to, you know, switch between apps with command tab, being able to use your menus and override shortcuts. Like, there's a lot of infrastructure that macOS provides that being inside of the browser locks you away from. I think what the team's been doing really well, from what I've been able to observe from the outside, is they don't just sort of hop on the macOS train and use all the functionality that it offers, but they really try to think about what people are actually trying to do with these features and build around that. So a lot of apps, like Sketch, is a perfect example of an app that is on a lot of macOS 10's infrastructure. But sometimes when you want to really do something truly different and revolutionary, you can't just depend on past paradigms. And so what they've been able to do is build an entirely new paradigm where you can collaborate simultaneously. And that's just not something that Apple provides as an infrastructure layer. So I'm happy to compromise being able to command tab between windows if I can be in the same file with two or three other people, or share a link to my file that others can open and jump into.
Being able to design with multiple people in the application is absolutely an incredible thing. But, you know, I try and think, like, when I'm in a Google Doc, I feel like I can't write if somebody's in a Google Doc. I guess I can see if you're working on a much larger application and maybe people aren't working on the same artboards at the same time. Kieran, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I totally get what you mean. I saw something funny on Twitter that poked fun at that exact thing, basically saying that nosy, micromanaging creative directors can now apply for remote roles because they won't have to sort of peer over your shoulder anymore. I think it's kind of just based on the individual. You know, like, I definitely see what you mean with the sort of normative pressure, I guess, of working under someone else's gaze. You know, that doesn't negate the value of the collaborative workflow in case you do need it on larger kind of multi-step projects. So yeah, I think it's up to the individual.
Payam, one of the other things, and I think you've obviously experimented with it a lot more than Kieran or I have, but one of the things is, like, my artboards, a lot of the applications that I design, our core application has a spreadsheet feature that's like its main things, and I think I've got like 100,000 rectangles in my sketch files. How does it handle with that many vector elements?
Well, so I am not as technically savvy as you know, some of the people working on this by any means, but from my understanding, Figma is using WebGL, which can leverage the graphic card and graphic processor as well as OpenGL can. So essentially what that means is, in practice, is that there's no difference in terms of performance between whether it's in a, quote, browser or, you know, a native wrapper. I think the reason why everyone's so shocked to see that Figma runs relatively smoothly compared to their sketch files is because it has access to all the same hardware.
You know, one of the things that I think is interesting, and I wanted to talk about the state of design tools as opposed to Figma, which I think was the most upvoted post in the last week or two. But we now have, as product designers, as UI designers, have all of these tools available. Like, before, it was really just Photoshop, or I knew people that did layouts in InDesign. What do you think that having all of these different tools means for the industry as a whole at large?
For the first, say, decade that I was designing, it was on the same suite of software. It was Photoshop, Illustrator, InDesign. And nothing changed. I mean, they would have incremental improvements, but nothing really fundamentally changed. If you look at where Photoshop is today compared to 3 years ago, it is dramatically a far better Photoshop than Photoshop 3 years ago was compared to the Photoshop 3 years before that. So this has even put Adobe under pressure to create better tools. That doesn't mean that Photoshop is going to be your, you know, you're not going to go back to Photoshop to design screens, But Photoshop has become a better Photoshop, and I think just the fact that there's competition and there's a significant number of innovators trying to solve problems around creative tools is amazing. Whenever you have a lot of different players in the game trying to solve a problem, you're ultimately going to have a much better solution because you have different people looking at it from different angles. So you don't have this sudden light bulb moment where everything changes. Every innovation is standing on the shoulders of innovations that came before it, and it's this sort of slow simmering soup that eventually, well, not eventually, it never really finalizes into anything, right? So I sort of started designing in an era where no one was caring about this type of stuff. No one really even cared about or understood why collaboration for designers was important or why our tools needed to change. And now everyone's thinking about it.
Yeah, definitely. Pam, I think you brought up a lot of good points, and the DN community has echoed those sentiments over the past couple of weeks. Namely that competition is healthy, competition is a good thing, and we've already seen it light a fire underneath Adobe's ass. And generally, I think it'll just increase the quality of what's out there. You know, I mean, I think it's a matter of the rising tide lifting all boats. And with this wave of design tools, I really think it's just going to increase the utility and increase the value of what's out there. Secondly, I think when we look at this sort of landscape of all these options, personally, I look at it through a lens of additive tool sets, not having to take one choice over the other in an absolute sense. Personally, I don't have too much trouble switching between them. If there's a specific task and there's a specific utility that one tool can give me with relative ease, then I don't really have a problem using that specific thing.
Don't you think fragmentation will create an issue with, you know, people's workflows? I mean, pretty much all of the designers I know, at least right now, you know, either have Photoshop or Sketch, and their workflows are built around those products. Don't you think that as, you know, more of these products are introduced and different companies adopt different products to use, that'll create issues?
Well, I mean, I'm only speaking from personal experience, but I think as long as the tools play nice together, it wouldn't be like that much of an impediment to the point where you would sort of refuse to use it or refuse to switch, right? I mean, clearly Sketch and Photoshop aren't going anywhere. You're going to be able to import Sketch artboards into no matter what. And kind of reflecting on Pam's point where, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of those who came before us, like, I think it'll be top of mind for new incumbents to want to play nice and integrate well with the existing tools. Personally, I think that interplay, as long as it doesn't have, you know, overbearing friction, I think it won't be like too much of an impediment.
You know, I've got to believe that as a profession, there are now more people coming into product design, kind of maybe moving just beyond UI design and looking at the complexities of these applications. And, you know, we didn't talk that much about Subform yet, where I think it's only a handful of days on their Kickstarter and they're like halfway to raising $100,000, which was another tool out there. I have to wonder if now maybe it's not the market's just growing and that now maybe there is room for more people than just Sketch and Photoshop.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, what we have to remember is that any of what we're producing is not the final product. Right. So as a designer, you're not creating the final product. You're just creating the blueprint to communicate with engineers how you want an experience to be, what you want a product to do. And of course, at a certain point, you get more into production and you have to be more specific about details. But for a lot of us, when we say, you know, it doesn't matter what tool you use, I think what a lot of people mean by that is just use the tool that lets you get the idea down. And then when it comes time to actually producing it into something that, you know, engineers have to work off of to build this much more complex piece of software, that's where we need to converge into a fewer set of tools. But even now with Figma, you can kind of jump from Sketch to Figma with a much flatter learning curve than when we jump from Photoshop to Sketch. So there's also a design language around design tools that is converging into, you know, you have your layers paddle on the left, you have your inspector on the right, you have your toolbar on the top, you have your canvas in the middle. Not a lot is changing.
Well, without a doubt, I think we've already started to see more organizations value design and attempt to be design driven in their ethos or their mission. Companies or VC funds like Designer Fund, for example, just kind of further corollary this, you know, that design as a discipline is starting to cascade throughout all levels of business and all levels of the organization, or at least design thinking. So I think that's just gonna expand the market like crazy. And by the same token, you know, that'll increase the number of stakeholders. It'll wanna, you know, take a peek at things or give feedback. So absolutely, I think you're right.
Well, and that's Envision's entire philosophy. Clark, who we'll have on the show here in the future, who's the CEO of Envision, they're selling a tool to designers, but more than that, they're selling collaboration to all of the designers' bosses. I mean, they're not going to sell the 50 designers at Etsy or wherever. They're going to sell them and then all of their bosses and all of the people in the QA team and the engineers. So I think that's one of the things that's interesting. They're selling the collaboration piece, which is, I mean, I think prototyping is part of it. But I mean, what they're trying to figure out is what Payam said before. How do you communicate this design to the engineers who have to figure out how to make it work and how to implement it?
I think it's why design systems and component-based design has become such a hot topic recently, because we sort of don't want to have to be drawing our UIs from scratch. We want to be able to build holistically, but also leverage the pieces that others have already built. So, you know, kind of coming back to things like multiplayer mode and simultaneous collaboration, I think a lot of this is just a platform for being able to share assets and share ideas very rapidly without it seeming very siloed. We have to even question what ownership means around these products. I mean, I don't think I have a single app on my phone that I use on a regular basis that's created by one person from end to end. Most things that we use have many different pieces, moving pieces to them that require research, that require consideration and testing and all these other things. And you have to be able to get many different people to work on the same problem together without stepping on each other's toes.
All right. So, you know, probably was about 2 or maybe 3 years ago that I guess a lot of my design process changed, or how I perceive product design changed, when I started moving, when I found Sketch and I started moving to Sketch. And so I'm curious, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years from now, what is the state of product design tools then? How do you guys see the future of these tools changing?
I guess I want to say I hope that some of these things will be possible. I don't know what will happen. I think this hopefully will happen sometime between the next 2 to 100 years. But one major theme for me is just enabling people to build something and invest in something that's larger than themselves, larger than just one project. If you look at, you know, traditionally how print has worked, you just sort of have one project that you control from end to end. I think we have to figure out ways of letting go of that sense of control and ownership and gatekeeping and find ways of working with other people, not just other designers, but people of other disciplines. Another aspect of it is really being able to leverage reusable and shareable modular components in the design tools that we have. So we already have that in code, but making that more accessible to more people will just mean that a lot more people will be able to experiment and explore ideas without having to have all of that technical knowledge. Another thing I've been thinking about a lot recently is just how disassociated we are from content and the data that we're designing around. I think we have to find better ways of actually understanding the content of what we're building for before we kind of create these shapes and forms around it. So instead of taking you know, some text and some images and shoving it into boxes that we've already built beforehand, we have to actually understand what that text and those images actually mean before we design containers for them.
That was pretty thorough. Kieran, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a tough one to follow. I don't have much in the way of a deep prediction, but I think tools like Webflow are indicative of where we might be headed. That is to say, like a what you see is what you get editor combined with, you know, code-enabled functionality, something that is intuitive but doesn't sacrifice power. I just hope that we can avoid any more episodes of like utopian promises, like AI driven magic, like the grid. God help us.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, personally, I'm not entirely sure. I think that you're probably going to see more powerful prototyping tools that I think this is part of Subform's deal. If I'm not mistaken, I believe they allow you to actually produce I think it's just for iOS, but actually produce a lot of the code that you need behind a lot of those animations. So it's maybe a step beyond what like InVision does. So I think we're going to start to see more of, I guess, a blend between designing and prototyping and implementing. I don't exactly know what that looks like right now, but that's kind of what I think.
Yeah, totally.
Well, Payam, Kieran, guys, thanks for joining me. This was fun.
Thanks so much for having us.
This is DNFM. I'm Sam Solomon. My guest today is Randy J. Hunt. He is the Vice President of Design at Etsy and the author of Product Design for the Web. Randy, thank you for joining me.
No, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Randy, before we started this interview, you told me that you are on an iPad and that you're doing this as part of an experiment to empathize with some of your users that don't use laptops, that really are just in the iOS ecosystem.
Yeah, that's right. I think specifically actually using an iPad as their primary computing device, right? Or maybe not primary, but as a desktop replacement. I think their primary for everybody is their phone. Right?
So how long have you been doing this experiment?
Well, in this round, I'd say just like a couple weeks, maybe a week and a half or something like that.
What have you discovered using the iPad as your primary device?
I'd say my biggest discovery so far is that expectations of like feature parity are not always met. You know, there's just a funny, I bring that expectation. I think a new user or something might not. I use Google Docs a lot, you know, and thing, you know, other like Google apps, and they're close and they're getting closer, but there's some gaps between what you get in the sort of native app experience and what you get in the, when you're using the sort of full-fledged version. That's been a funny adjustment for me.
I kind of feel like you've just got so much when you're doing work and you're, you know, if you've got to get into a spreadsheet or something like that, I just feel like the mouse things are, you're so accurate and it's so quick. And maybe that's just because that's how we're trained, but
like I'm talking to you and this iPad's in landscape mode because I've got it hooked up to one of like the Apple like keyboard covers, and the experience of where to use the keyboard or tap on the screen. It doesn't feel to be an experience many app designers have really considered or optimized for. It's a fairly like limited use case thus far. You know, anything that's naturally a text input feels kind of baked in at like the OS level in a way. You know, when you're in a tap only world, like if you remove the keyboard and you're just tapping around, this question kind of goes away. But if you start to like navigate with your keys, then you might hit some funny walls where like actually what you have to do is tap on the screen. So we're living in this funny in-between world. It feels like this stuff's going to get resolved in the next, you know, 18 to 24 months with the next iterations of these pieces of hardware. But this is like, you know, the small iPad Pro. It is remarkably close to my like MacBook. I use that tiny like newer MacBook, you know, that's not an Air and not a MacBook Pro. They're very close in their like computing power, it feels like, and the speed. And yet like one doesn't have a touchscreen. And the other one isn't Mac OS.
If you've got a keyboard for, I guess, your iPad Pro, at least for if you're doing a whole lot of typing, I guess that is pretty similar.
It is pretty similar. Yeah, and you can command tab through your apps, you know. It's a funny, these things are really overlapping with each other. What I love about it, like from a work standpoint, it's just a focused environment. When you're sitting in an email app, you're only in email. When you move over into a notes app, you're like only taking notes. I really like that experience. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I thought that might be something the audience would be interested in. I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about your background. You've got a bachelor's and a master's degree in graphic design, right?
Yeah, that's right. A bachelor's in graphic design. My master's is in a program whose DNA is probably in visual communication and graphic design. But the premise of the curriculum, the program is called The Designer as Entrepreneur, is really centered around the idea of designers being the sort of author or originator of ultimately business ideas. In its origins, it looked a lot like graphic designers and maybe even like illustrators. It started a lot with like printed ephemera books or other things like that. And as the program matured and just the world around it changed, it became much more like the designer as the originator of a sort of fully fledged business concept that used the sort of leveraged design as part of its offering.
Well, and I think that makes sense. Today, you've got things like Designer Fund, and they're just backing startups whose founders are designers. How'd you end up in software? Where is the bridge between this design slash business type program and working on software products?
I would say there's probably three key things, and these are related to each other. I'll talk about them linearly. I think the first is that my dad was a software developer to some extent, and computers and technology were sort of always in our home growing up. And as I got into both music and then later sort of graphic design, software or like manipulating software or sort of using technology as part of the process just felt super familiar and second nature to me. It was the same way my dad would kind of hack on stuff in a way. So they were kind of inseparable. So even as I was doing sort of visual communication or like more traditional graphic design training, just the technology part of it felt like part of the canvas in a way, or part of the toolkit. And I've just always was comfortable kind of, you know, opening the hood, like metaphorically, and, you know, hacking away at some weird music plugin for some, you know, multi-track recording, even though I didn't really know what I was doing. Like, I don't know, change some values in the thing and see what happens. That kind of world just felt really familiar to me. And then as I started doing more client service design projects, it just tended to be that I was, whether it was, you know, somewhere I was interning at or as I started to do work independently and then ultimately started Design Studio, the nature of the either the solution set I would offer or the clients I would gravitate towards always had this digital need, right? Increasingly, that client service work started to look more and more like fairly lightweight software projects, like small custom CMSs or small customizations of things that help them communicate with their customers or whatever their sort of audience might be. So that was kind of number two, like more than brochureware started to be part of the like service offering in the context of design. It was never like we're hiring you to build, you know, software for us. It was we're hiring you to work on, you know, some brand thing. Then the brand thing needs some communication program. The communication program needs a place to live, and then you need to administer that content, you know? And so you started to get towards stuff like that. And then with a client of mine, we basically went into business together around a business concept that was an iteration of his existing business. So we formed this e-commerce marketplace together. It was called Supermarket. And we built from the ground up the software that powered that project. I think we bonded beyond just our, you know, interest in this sort of a market opportunity as we saw it. We also just bonded over the fact that he and I both kind of like, you know, hobby hacked on stuff in the background, like spinning up little Rails apps because it was fun, you know? And yeah, so when we started up that business together, that contributed, I think, to our interest in also, you know, building the software that ran the business. That is sort of an integral part of the business. And so that was really the first time that I'd built or been part of building, you know, a software product from scratch that was reasonably complex. And then kind of from there forward, like building the software part of that experience and also the nature of that business where it was no longer sort of in the consulting or like client service business, but was, you know, as the co-owner of this thing that made money while we were sleeping, right? And wasn't about like pitching for work or billing or invoicing for time or some other way of, you know, sort of communicating the value. That was, I don't think I would ever go back, honestly.
Well, and I was going to ask you, going from an agency or a studio to kind of a product mindset, those are different. What was that like for you?
For me, it was just after we launched the, well, there's a part that already felt different, which was I had partners, which I never really had before. I mean, it certainly had the feeling of partnership or like collaboration with people, no doubt. And there were some long running sort of employees and collaborators in the studio I was running. But in the new business in Supermarket or Supercorp was the company. We had some, a few other things going on beyond this marketplace, Supermarket, really had a partner, partners. And that felt different already just in the relationship and sort of your orientation towards the work. You had sort of shared stakeholders that were kind of all in it together. But from a business standpoint, and that sort of model of not being this agency model, kind of running a product or a service, it was really once we first launched, time feels fuzzy to me now, but it was probably 9 or 10 months after we had started building the product that we launched out in the world. And we had a very basic dashboard, you know, when we first launched, to help us see some very basic like business metrics. But I just remember we launched it one evening and then I kind of went out to this party and went home, woke up the next day and just looked at the metrics. And this is small beans, right? But it was overnight, our first night. We had sold, I don't know, $1,200 worth of stuff. Now for us, we were only taking a percentage of it. So it wasn't a ton of money that we got, you know.
But that's still cool, right? Like that's.
And it was like, oh my God, I was sleeping. And this happened, you know, like the machine worked, not in some, I don't mean machine in some like, you know, pejorative way. I mean, like the thing we had built served its purpose, created value, like people experienced it. And my involvement was indirect, you know, sort of we're designing the system and the system does the thing. And for me, it was, I was like, this is amazing. I was like, oh my gosh, like what, you know, what else can we do that works that way? You know, just really kind of changed my, I think it could have been described to me intellectually and I would have understood it, but to experience it, I kind of had this visceral thing that was like, oh yeah, this feels awesome. You know? So again, it was small beans at the time, but it's an indicator of what can happen. You know?
The interesting thing I think about services versus products in the service world, growth is linear. You don't make another dollar unless you bill another hour. There's some variation, but that's mostly true. In the product world, revenue is in a lot of ways decoupled from the amount of time you put into it. So, you know, you can sleep, as you said before, or you can continue iterating and kind of tinkering with this product and try and find ways for it to make more money. If a product works, growth is nonlinear.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's why you see in the world of the, like in the client service world, one, you see a trajectory towards the more like consulting and strategy model where you can just charge more, you know, you can charge more for that time or start to get out of the realm of time where you're talking about value, you know, some value creation sort of irregardless of time. Which requires a degree, I think, of experience and sophistication in the delivery of the work and also just great salesmanship and really depends on developing often high-level relationships inside organizations. By that, I just mean like super senior, right? Like you're getting the CMO of a company to buy into this, you know, positioning program or something. Or you see, I think it's why you have seen for a long time the strength of advertising agencies more than any other kind of creative service, because they're also billing, you know, the big ones are billing on the media buys and the media spend and getting a markup there where you can create a lot of value or extract a lot of value from the system where you're not selling just the concept or the creative. You're also selling some thinking and then some operations and markup on the delivery channels. I think that's why you see, you know, big global ad agencies are just plain bigger than big global design agencies because of that nature of the model, you know, and they're a lot more valuable. You're taking that ad dollar part of that equation. So I think that's why you see that happening. And there, those are the two kind of vectors in that world for the most part. Where to your point, the relationship between effort and output in the product world is, or like time and value is, there's a lot more levers and there's a lot more variability in some ways for better or worse, right? It can, I guess all these things can kind of fail hard, but, the products have to work.
Right. Right now.
Yeah, and the your ad campaign has to work to get future work, in theory. But the initial work, you get paid for whether it works or not, right? And in the product world, that's not the case. And even when it starts working, you may not be getting paid enough. You got to reach a certain scale.
Right. Well, that's especially with SaaS companies. I mean, that's like the trough for like 2 years. You know, SaaS companies spend most of their money on engineering and designers and sales. And usually it takes a while. It takes like 2 years for that to kind of ramp up. A lot of people think if it works, it can be kind of predictable. But the other interesting thing about SaaS is when you have a subscription, the product has to be good every single month. And if the customer is not getting value out of it every single month, then they'll leave.
It's true to some extent. I think the beauty of subscription model things is if the product is reasonably good, the opportunity cost of switching over time goes up. So you get that lock in. I think subscription products are super smart just from a predictable revenue standpoint as well. Even if there was, you know, dynamics of new customers and then customers sort of graduating out of the system or something like that, you can learn over time fairly quickly some trends, and you can have predictable projections of sort of top line, like money coming in and what it costs you to run it in a pretty awesome way. It's funny. I feel like enough time has passed that we don't necessarily give as much credit to the, like, you know, shoulders we're standing on, you know, just because it's easier to, like, there's more stuff in the ecosystem, or you might come into this world and not see those sort of stepping stones. But man, did the people behind Basecamp, you know, used to be called 37 Signals, they laid the groundwork for so many people in thinking about subscription software as a service in small enough chunks for an audience that's like non-enterprise, like a kind of consumer pricing.
Well, that, and I mean, DHH has invented Rails, which basically powered a lot of the first big kind of, database backed web applications. They hit several home runs on several points.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that's, you know, maybe the idea of like project management or something isn't as sexy on the surface as it used to be or something. I mean, maybe that's not true. There's still people trying to chip away at that, but I mean, they killed it, you know, like they did a really, I mean, they've built a great solid businesses as well. And like interesting branding approach and great ways of like marketing their kind of ideas as like thought leaders in some sense, even just some of those basic business mechanics that we accept as part of the canon in a way of like building software products did not exist when they were starting the stuff. Or if they did, they were in corners, you know, and they really like formalized some concepts that we, you know, anybody today kind of thinking of a project in their living room that they might like turn into a software service are just the basic, you know, it's like immediately where you'd start about like what models you would consider. I think that stuff's super interesting.
My guest is Etsy Vice President of Design, Randy J. Hunt. I'd like to take a quick break from our conversation to go through a few of our featured job board listings. Blue Ant Media is looking for a senior UX designer in Toronto. PillPack is looking for a product designer in Boston. Rector is hiring a few design positions in New York. Odin Technologies is looking for a product designer in New York. And Mark Agency needs a UI designer in Cambridge. So once again, if you're looking for a new job, a new career, you can find all of those listings and more at designernews.co/jobs. Now back to our conversation. Based on this conversation, I think we could probably sit and talk about products all day. But I'd like to talk a little bit about you. You started at Etsy 6 years ago. You were the first person on the design team. How'd you end up at Etsy?
So, yeah, I think, Etsy started in 2005. I joined in 2010. And there had been designers at Etsy previously. I mean, maybe from best I can tell, from sort of historical records, there's maybe three, you know, at the like, I mean, three concurrently, maybe only two. of a mix of maybe like four people over those 5 years or something, and a couple of consultants or contractors. At the time I joined, there were no designers. So it was kind of right at another like moment of change for the organization where Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, was coming back as CEO. He had kind of stepped away from a leadership role at the company for 18 months or so and was coming back. And I would say hit reset in some ways. And there was two product managers who I would say after maybe like 3 or 4 months were also sort of part of my team. Like I was responsible for leading the product management group as well for a little bit. So in some sense, starting from zero or like the first designer, but also factually, like not the first designer at Etsy or something. People had laid the groundwork and the business was a healthy and fast growing business by the time I joined.
Well, that's a good clarification. So when you joined, what were some of the first things that you were working on? What types of design needs did Etsy have?
So there's an internal kind of operational challenge, which is funny to think about now because it feels so sort of internal and not like customer focused at all, which is like the world we're living in. But at the time, Etsy was in a place where its engineering organization had gotten very strong very quickly, which is in general a good thing. There's no sort of criticism there. It just has has some side effects, which were we were building lots of stuff and shipping lots of stuff, and it wasn't clear. I mean, one, the stuff just wasn't well designed, so it's creating some like crunchy sort of user experience things, and then brand stuff too, although we didn't really start to pay attention to that or take action on what we were observing as like brand challenges until later. There just wasn't enough kind of like collaboration points. The first design needs were like make design happen at all, right? And it was kind of like make inroads or like form partnerships with the engineering organization to really treat the way we worked as not engineering, but rather like product development. There's a sort of like full-fledged thing that involved product and design and engineering. So that was really problem number one. The way we did that, the tactics in a way, were there's another designer who started the same week I did, awesome guy, a guy named Jay Carlson, who just recently started leading design at Betterment. Good, like solid dude. You should talk to him. He and I started around the same time, and we essentially divide and conquer. We were like, here's the part of the experience that you're going to work on. Here's the part of the experience that I'm going to work on. And we kept in close communication to kind of had some shared principles. But honestly, the very first thing was just like start designing stuff. And that's not to sound like willy-nilly, like, oh, just start designing. But it was literally like produce anything. Like we need to sort of have credibility with this engineering organization that we like, one, show them we exist, two, show them the kinds of like basic things we can deliver and start to form a partnership and then really build from there. And a similar approach or a similar kind of mindset has been how we've built up this design organization over the last 6.5 years that started with like sort of boots on the ground work in every sort of additional area or discipline of design that we've been growing to cover and introduce into the organization's kind of like repertoire in a way. Start the boots on the ground experience, prove the value of it and build it out from there, and focus a lot on forming the working relationships with the key partners first, and then expand the sort of rings of partnership over time. For me, that's been effective. It's probably part of my like personal kind of leadership style or something. It's not a version that comes in and says, here's the vision, take it or leave it. That's one version.
it's more tactical,
or like, here's the vision, trust me. It really starts from a place of, even though I might have that vision in mind or something like destination, it really starts with the trust me part, right? It's like, what do I need to deliver, or what kind of experience do you, partner, need to have to start to form a trusting relationship that we're going to like leverage that trust and build on it to get to the next place we need to go. The next place is sort of the next place for design, the next place for Etsy as an organization, the next place for our customers, the next place for our business. It's kind of like all these things together. So it's not just, how do we make design better? What's the next thing we can do, build on this to make a better experience for the customer? What's the thing we can do to sort of prepare the organization for its next stage of growth? What's the, you know, what's the next problem the partner is trying to solve that we can help them?
Well, and Etsy's gone through many stages of growth since you've joined, and the design team has obviously gotten much bigger. Certainly there were either operational or cultural or personnel challenges that you guys faced.
Yep. There are a lot of challenges that come along with it. There's a recruiting challenge. There's a onboarding challenge. And the onboarding challenge is maybe two or threefold. There's the sort of cultural onboarding, which is maybe a subset of just like sort of education in the onboarding experience. But then there's also just the volume of onboarding, right? So like if you're, it's a compounding interest, like exponential growth thing, right? It's a onboarding one designer at a, one designer a month is easier than onboarding three designers a month is easier than designing, onboarding 10 designers in a month. So there's sort of a volume challenge that comes along with that as well in terms of onboarding. There's sort of a management capacity challenge. So you sort of hit these, what would I call them? They're like inflection points, right? Where the existing sort of management infrastructure, there's not enough, right? It's become impractical. You need to introduce like more managers or somehow change the way management or that responsibility works so that everyone's just like delivering well, that the managers are not stretched too thin, that the people they're managing are getting the right level of attention and guidance, that communication is happening kind of at the right frequency you'd expect at various parts of the organization. As you said, it's like sort of more specialized. So sort of like a role definition challenge, which is what's your space to explore in and what are your explicit responsibilities and what are the bounds of those and where the overlaps of those, how sort of vertically specialized are you and how like horizontal of a player are you, like almost the existential questions around those things that happen at like an organizational level and at an individual level. Those are all kind of management challenges. I mean, Etsy has always been in a growth mode ever since I've been here, right? So that's one context. But I think that those same kinds of challenges would exist in the opposite of a growth mode. You know, like imagine you're in a business that was having to get smaller or leaner for whatever reason. You're going to have a different kind of recruiting challenge, but it's still a recruiting challenge, right? What if you need to backfill a person in an organization that has a reputation for getting smaller? That is an interesting challenge, right? You gotta onboard people in an environment where maybe what you're needing to ask them to do is cover more territory than you're familiar with onboarding people for, or maybe the stakes feel higher. So I think that those themes that I just kind of outlined they still apply whether you're a more sort of like stable, whether you're in growth mode, it's more stable, maybe you're shrinking, but you go one layer deeper, and then like the nature of those challenges are probably very different. But it's it's recruiting, it's onboarding. It's scaling the individual, scaling the team, management capacity, and sort of role definition in a way, like how much focus and breadth there are. Maybe the other one would be what additional value can you add, or what can you sort of bring to the business as part of its expertise? And for us, that's been, you call it a challenge. I think it's super fun, but it's what else can you do? And that's not in some like, let's just do as much as we can, but there's all these kind of adjacent disciplines and expertise that you're not covering when you're a smaller organization. And as you have become a larger organization, you have the very lucky kind of like luxurious opportunity to start to tackle some of those things if you choose to.
Well, so one of the things that I do think you guys have done exceptionally well is build teams. I mean, they're pretty prominent voices, like Diana and Cap are pretty well known within the design community. I know they're elsewhere now, but I know several people who are at Etsy, who work at Etsy, who are incredibly talented. What's the secret sauce? You know, where does Etsy get all of these talented people?
Good question. I don't know. No, I'm kidding. I can't tell you the secret sauce. No, I think that actually, I mean, this will sound obvious when I say it, and we can talk about some other things where I can maybe take a little more credit or be a little more specific about it. But like one substantial contributing factor, I think, is what Etsy stands for in the world and what we're trying to make happen. And the sort of company culture that has developed because of that. That is really, really attractive to people, you know, and that's not the only reason. I don't think that would, you know, that's not going to keep someone around if they're frustrated with their day-to-day work or something. But Etsy is a brand that is easy to believe in, I think. And it is a company whose values align with many people's personal values in a way that does not cause them to sort of question how they're spending their time day to day. And I think a lot of people seek that meaning in their work.
So what about the brand? Is it that, you know, good design kind of breeds other good design? Is it, you know, how people perceive the brand of Etsy as being something that is very design centric?
I don't think so. I think that that's maybe a second order thing. And we can talk about that more. I actually think that it's, there's probably two key parts of this. One is Etsy is attempting to imagine commerce or reimagine commerce, as we say in some, you know, marketing language about it, right? In a way that is intensely people centric and happens at more of a human scale. And I think that resonates with a lot of people, like designer or not. It's a bit of a antidote to a lot of experiences we have in the world that maybe accept as sort of the current condition, but aren't totally comfortable with. So there's that. I think the other related one is Etsy is about empowering other creative people, right? We're trying to help. So this is where I think it's like, it's broader or more general than design and the designiness of it. I mean, you could define design super broadly and then it's inclusive, but it's sort of this belief that everybody is inherently creative and that if you want to use that creativity to be successful or find a level of fulfillment on whatever your own terms for that might be, Etsy wants to help make that happen. And that's just super easy to, I think, get behind at like an emotional level, you know? Like right now there's 1.7 million active sellers on Etsy, which is a small number compared to like the number of Facebook users or something. You imagine that that's 1.7 million like small and micro businesses. This isn't like just a person casually consuming some content. There's like serious value exchange attached to all those people. And for some of them, it is their primary means of making a living. And for a big chunk of other ones, it's supplemental income for their families. There's something so sort of honest and authentic about that, that I think is easy for a lot of people to get behind, not just designers. When I'll talk to designers we're recruiting or something, it's like, why do you want to work at Etsy? You know, what interests you about Etsy? That's always one of the answers, which like isn't particularly like distinguishing, right? You're like, yeah, I hear that all day, every day, but it's also true. But I think if you were to talk to any other department inside the company, the people they're talking to are saying the exact same thing. Why does somebody want to work on the finance team at Etsy? It's for that exact same reason. You're like, man, Etsy's values align with my personal values. So that's a huge contributing factor that cannot be undersold. Because I think if we built an incredible design culture, or you take two organizations or two businesses with equally incredible design culture, and then you have one who's sort of purpose in the world and the way it thinks about itself naturally aligns with what you would describe as your own personal values. I think that one kind of, you know, the scales tip in that direction. And so it's a very lucky set of conditions to sort of be building a team under, not just a design team, but a team in general. Because certainly we're working to like embody those values and clarify that message like out in the world from a brand standpoint, but I didn't create those things, right? Like that's sort of in the DNA of the company. And so it's a really like beautiful kind of beautiful foundation to build on.
This interview is running a little bit long. It's been fantastic. I've got a few more questions I do want to get to before I let you go.
Are you saying I talk too much?
It's good. Like I said, I could sit and talk all day.
Yeah. I'll give you speed round answers.
All right. So you've overseen both brand and product design at Etsy for a long time. What are some of the distinguishing qualities you see between one type of designer versus the other?
Certainly, on the brand design side, it's much more rooted in communication design and its origins. much more in its day-to-day work intrinsically coupled with marketing. Now all these, you know, all these groups kind of partner together. So that's not to say that product and marketing are somehow, you know, walled off from each other. And its system level thinking is often about identity and then delivery, like systems of delivery, and systems of sort of like artifact efficiency in some sense. But for product designers, I think it's much more about, I mean, for us, much more about a software experience for the most part. The utility and ease of use and the sort of emotional experience of using a thing as opposed to like receiving a message. So I think those would be some distinguishing things about the work. The distinguishing things about the people, I don't know, the technical skills they have in some sense. I mean, there's certainly, I think it's mostly that, honestly. I mean, there are certainly some people who are like extreme specialists that just would never cross those lines. But for a lot of design generalists, they're capable of thinking across both those spectrums. It more has to do with what skills do they have to like deliver on that thinking in a day-to-day environment. You know?
Well, so the last thing I want to ask you is, you know, who are the designers that inspired you, and why do you look up to them, or why do you find them inspiring?
Yeah. I think that, maybe I'll try to do a quick version of this. several of the people I look up to are also, teachers of mine in grad school, which are the main reasons why I went to grad school at SVA, mostly to spend time with them. So I'll be quick. Milton Glaser, primarily because of this conceptual and like is the intellectual framework he sort of puts around, design more than anything else. It's not so much about the delivery of the specific work itself. I think it's, you know, his work kind of has its place in time, but the sort of intellectual dialogue around design, the responsibility of designers, how designers should behave, to me was always really inspiring. And just the degree of thoughtfulness in any of his dialogue about, you know, a logo or a choice of type or something was just much deeper than I would say like on average, but also not so arty academic in some like experimental sense. You know, he's a commercial artist, right? There's that. I think for me, Stefan Sagmeister as well, he's a teacher in grad school. The sort of sheer inventiveness and also the sampling from the art world, which to me, I'm not saying like, oh, product design should sample from the art world, but rather the understanding that you can sample from other disciplines to kind of stretch the meaning or understanding of your own in the abstract. Bruce Mau is also a communication designer for the most part, who over time expanded his remit to really be about like the broadest definition of design possible. You know, how do you design cultural experiences? How do you design, you know, life in a city? Think that broad definition of design. An architect who used to work for Rem Koolhaas, a guy named Joshua Prince Ramis, has a studio called Rex, I think is one of the more interesting like systems thinkers in terms of like the built environment. And to me, that was really inspiring. You'll notice I'm naming a lot of things that aren't like software in some sense.
Well, that's interesting. That's why I asked the question.
Yeah. And I actually think it's funny that I mentioned them earlier, the sort of design approach, or almost like the working approach of the 37 Signals team in the early days were really inspiring to me.
That's a pretty comprehensive list.
So I won't give you, there's no product designers in that list necessarily, which I find, you know, refreshing. Try to look outside the space for points of reference, you know.
Absolutely. Well, Randy, it's been absolutely fantastic talking with you today. I appreciate you joining me.
Yeah, likewise. A lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
My guest, Randy J. Hunt, is the VP of Design at Etsy. This is DNFM. All right, everybody, that is going to wrap it up for episode 7. If you enjoyed the show, make sure to subscribe. DNFM is on SoundCloud, iTunes, and you can always listen to the show online at designernews.co/podcast. Please continue to tell us what you love and hate about the show. We're on Twitter at designernewsbot. If you want to reach out to me personally, I'm on Twitter at Samuel R. Solomon. While we love producing the show, a lot of hard work goes into making every single episode. If you would like to support DNFM, please get in touch with us about sponsorship opportunities. Once again, my guest is Etsy Vice President of Design, Randy J. Hunt. I'm Sam Solomon, and this is DNFM.